Okay, well, thank you. Well, it's always a pleasure to be here in Santa Barbara, especially when we have, you know, 118 temperatures in Phoenix. So yeah, everything's cold to me compared to what I'm used to. So every talk about outflow starts with the image of M82 because, you know, it's the most beautiful outflow picture that you have. And here's a, you know. Is there another picture? Is there another outflow in the universe?
Yes, everyone shows
M82. Well, because it's so nice. Yeah, there's nice, there are more. Yeah, you'll see that there are others. This one, you have this nice composite image. You know, you see the stars, and you see the infrared from Spitzer in red. But, you know, I think one of the main reasons people show this is because the X-ray image is so nice. You see this really hot gas, which is thought to be the driver of the other phases, or at least it's very important. But usually, you know, we don't have access to that, you know, observations of X-ray gas. So almost always, you are looking at lines typically in absorption. So there are a lot of atomic lines that people use depending on the redshift of the host that they're looking at. So, you know, sodium 1 is very useful for nearby work. And then as you go out, you have, you know, iron 2, magnesium 2, silicon 2. This is not so cold, 06. But it's still very cold compared to the tens of million degree gas that you're seeing in the X-ray that driving the outflow. And of course, we heard a lot about observations of CO and C2. So this came up several times. This object, quasar at 6.42 with C2 emission and these broad wings. And here's zirconium, a sample of outflows measured in CO. And of course, Alberto Bellotto spoke a lot about NGC 253 in the very first talk. So before we get to the cold gas, let's talk a little about the hot gas. So if you have a starburst in here, it's generating gas at, say, 10 million degrees, something like that. That's going to flow out roughly freely. And the observations where you have them are usually well described with a pretty simple model, the Chevalier-Clegg model, which is just you're continuously adding hot gas, expanding out freely. And the interesting thing about that is that the sonic point for that is always sort of the edge of where you're adding the hot gas. So the sonic point's right here. And then out here, you have gas that's cooling pretty rapidly, mostly through expansion. And it's moving supersonically. Right? And so that's what the hot gas is doing. But usually, we have observations of colder gas atomic molecular. And we've got to use that to infer what's going on with the hot gas. So what I'd like to talk about for at least most of the talk is sort of this basic problem of what happens when you have a cold cloud here and it's being overtaken by a hot wind. And maybe you think you know, but there's much more to it than you've heard before. Or probably that you heard before. So before I jump into the problem itself, let's just talk about scales just a little bit. So I'll be talking about the case that in which you have cooling, but also conduction. And in this case, here's the equations that you're solving, right? So they're just hydro equations. And then cooling comes in here with an n squared. So it's optically thin cooling I'm talking about. And then you have conduction. So it's electron thermal conduction. And that's just given, we're going to assume the Spitzer value. But whatever you assume here for a law, so this is a saturated point, and this is the Spitzer value. But these equations are invariant if I take length to some factor alpha times length, time to some factor alpha times time, and rho to some factor rho divided by alpha. Right? So if I rescale everything, then I get the exact same equations. And so as long as I talk about lengths in terms of cloud sizes, then everything should just depend on column density, velocity, and temperature, right? So you can, I don't need to do simulations with 10 parsecs, 100 parsecs, various size clouds for a given column, then I should always get the same answer, okay? That should still be true with, even if you have B fields, which I won't talk about, but gravity would break that. But we don't think that, that gravity is that important for these clouds. This brings us back to the classic paper of Climacchi and Colella, where here they have this hot wind passing over the cold cloud. And the characteristic timescale here is the time for the shock that's generated in the cold cloud to cross that cloud. Okay? And that velocity is slower than the velocity of the exterior medium by a factor of this root chi here. This chi is a density contrast between the cloud and the exterior medium. So the cloud's denser, so the shock moves through it more slowly, and hence the crossing time for that shock, which is called the cloud crushing time in literature, is longer than, you know, the time it takes the hot wind to get from here to here. This shock that propagates through here is much, much slower. Now, if you have no cooling, then what happens is this shock makes its way to the back, there's a reflection, and then it disrupts the entire cloud. So without cooling, you just always disrupt a cloud such as this within one or two cloud crushing times. Right, so that's a cloud crushing time. Now, if cooling is efficient, you still disrupt the cloud on one or two cloud crushing times as long as the exterior medium is subsonic. Okay, so in that case, you have a Kelvin-Helmholtz instability that develops along the side of the cloud, and you can work out the time it takes for that instability to grow, and you find you get the same answer. You get that even though the cloud can cool, it's just shredded by this instability on one or two cloud crushing times. It's exactly the same time that arises. But if the exterior flow is supersonic, then that instability is suppressed. It's actually suppressed strongly. So there's a factor of m squared. And so this cloud can actually live a long time if the exterior medium is supersonic. And if I can put it into an outflow outside of this driving region, well, that exterior flow is going to be supersonic. So that case marries a lot of study. Now, this is all, you can also relate this to the velocity evolution of the cloud. So you see a cloud, it's coming at you, and using it to say something about the outflow that's pushing it around. And if you go through the numbers, so Alberto gave us this picture of trying to blow on a bowling ball and how hard that would be and how long you might have to do it to get that bowling ball to go quickly. And so you can ask, well, what's the velocity of this cloud given its mass and the rate at which I'm depositing momentum on the front of it? And you could compare that to how long it's going to take to disrupt. Okay, so you can say, how long will it take me to speed up the cloud, say, to the velocity of the exterior medium? And what is that in terms of these cloud crushing times? And you see you have this factor here on the bottom. The higher the density contrast between this guy and this guy, the more number of cloud crushing times you need it to stay intact to be accelerated to a velocity that's comparable to exterior flow. Okay? So that problem becomes harder. And so that makes it the case such that if your exterior medium is subsonic, you should always, always expect this thing to disrupt. Yes? I'm sorry, what? I don't include viscosity. But we could talk about that later. Maybe that's an issue. But I mean, that would be moderated by protons instead of electrons. Be less, but it's worth talking about. Let's talk. There's no viscosity in one. I'll show you. Let me say that. Okay, so the first thing I want to show you are just hydrodynamic simulations of a cold cloud being overtaken by a hot wind at various Mach numbers. We did it with the flash code, and I'll just show you the picture how we do this. It's kind of a funny volume that we use. So this cloud that we assume is 100 parsecs in radius, and this is our box. It's actually wider this way than it is that way. And the reason is, if you take a box that's too narrow, there's a Mach cone that's going to develop around this cloud here, and you won't get the right Mach angle. You'll just get a flat, or at least a one that is much too flat, if you try to truncate this box. And then that'll give you completely different results because you don't have the right structure around it. So you need a kind of large volume, even though you don't need especially good resolution out here. So we force the highest resolution around here, around the cloud, and we maintain it there at all times. I don't let that thing derefine and refine. I'm always holding that fixed and the lowest out here. And the other game that we play is that you're going to see some of these clouds live a long time. So they start to go right out of the back of the box, and that's not so good. So we changed frame, right? So once per cloud crushing time, I just go in and I change my frame of my that I'm working in so that the thing doesn't drift out the back of the box. And if you keep track of what frame you're in, then you can reconstruct the whole velocity, evolution, everything. Okay. This is just a table of some of the different cases that we studied. Essentially, the important thing here is we did a subsonic case and then ones at a variety of Mach numbers. And the higher the Mach number, you could think of this as inserting a cold cloud into an outflow further out from the driving region. Okay? And then depending on exactly, the energy per unit mass that was deposited into the hot flow, then you could have various velocities at which that exterior flow might be moving at. Okay? So here's a typical subsonic case. Well, this is the one subsonic case we did. This would be inserting the gas near the driving region or within the driving region. And so the three lines that I show here, they're the fraction of mass, okay, that's left in the cloud defined in three different ways. This is everything with a density above the initial density, everything with a density above a third the initial density, and everything above a tenth the initial density. Okay, so if you're really, really picky and you say, well, I only think that stuff that's exactly above the initial density of the cloud is still cloud, well, then you get this evolution here. But as long as you're a little bit generous, you say, well, if you're half the cloud density, and remember the density contrast here is something like, in this case, I think it's like 1,000, we'll still call you cloud, then you get results that aren't much dependent on how you define that. So you can pretty robustly define what it means to be part of a cloud. And I should mention the resolution is 64 cells per cloud radius. So here's a cloud, and it comes apart in a handful of cloud crushing times, as expected. But if I go to a very high Mach number case, well, look at this thing. It's now 20 cloud crushing times, and you still have about a third or a quarter of it at high density. Okay, so it's not true that this thing can only maintain itself for one or two cloud crushing times. That actually is very dependent on the environment in which it's found. And here's a plot where I plot everything by Mach number, so it's increasing as you go down. And all the lines are scaled by cloud crushing times. It gives you a visual impression of, just how puny the life of this guy is compared to this high Mach number one here. Right? So it's really very different. Okay. So we can try to quantify that a little bit further. So we define a handful of times. So we measured the time that the cloud was down to 90% of its mass, 75, 50, and 25. We call it T90, T75, T50, T25. Okay. And this is sort of a picture. This is of the lowest Mach number case, what the cloud looks like at these different times. And you can see that the evolution is kind of what I told you, what you might have expected, that it starts to get shredded. Okay, by this instabilities, and you can see, thing coming apart. And now I can go forward, I can go to higher and higher Mach numbers, and I'll show you how these clouds look at these characteristic times of 90, 75, 50, and 25. And you'll see that their morphologies change a lot. Okay? They become these stretched out things, and they're much denser. They become sort of cometary looking. And they actually are disrupted by being stretched out and not by KH. I'll show you that in a second. And the nice thing is there's a very simple fit to this evolution. So I said, well, it's more complicated than what you know, but it's actually not that much more complicated. If you want to estimate how long a cold cloud would live, well, there's this factor, alpha, that I just say, well, what does it mean to live to a certain time? Does it mean lose 50% of your mass? Well, then put 2.5 for alpha. Use 4 for alpha. Does it mean lose 75% of your mass? Then put 6 here. So it's just some number of cloud crushing times, but then there's a Mach number factor. Okay. So if Mach number 0, it's what we knew, but if it's high, then it's much longer, and it's fit by this simple fit. And the reason that these high Mach number clouds are disrupted is actually not due to the growth of this instability, it's because of the pressure difference actually between the back and the front. So when you have a Mach cone very near at the tip of the Mach cone, you have a very, very strong pressure that develops, you know, because you have a planar shock there. But here, there's an oblique shock, and the pressure difference is much less. And so at the front of the cloud, you have a very high pressure, and on the back, you have less, and that's why it's stretched out. And you can work out the time scale of that stretching, and that sets that square root factor that I told you. So that's all stuff you can use. So you think, okay, well, great. So if we can insert clouds into a flow somewhere where the Mach number is high, perhaps this will be a way to accelerate clouds to significant velocities. But unfortunately, having high Mach number flow comes at a price. I don't only have my instabilities suppressed, but I'm also I'm compressed myself. You saw that the densities are much higher. And so the area that cloud now presents to the flow that's overtaking it is much less, and its rate that it accretes momentum is therefore much less as well. And so while some of these clouds live many, many cloud crushing times, say 30 even, this one is still only at about 18% of the exterior velocity of flow when it's essentially disrupted. And on this axis is absolute velocity. I hope you can see that from where you are. And then this one is the velocity of the cloud relative to the exterior flow. And I think there's one where it gets up to 30. Yeah, this is the best one here. But most of them are more around 10%. So it can make you live a long time. Doesn't especially help with accelerating. Okay, so now what about thermal conduction? So these were just hydrodynamic simulations I showed you. What if we also consider electron thermal conduction? So we put this in as Spitzer, and we also measured when things were saturated and counted for that. Refinements are the same and everything. You can go back to these classic papers from Len Cowie and McKee and Cowie and talk about a cloud that's stationary in a hot flow and how in some limits you actually grow the cloud because of cooling around it. And in others, the cloud evaporates. So we're going to consider what happens if you have a supersonic flow overtaking such a clump. All right. So there's two cases. If you have a low column density, then these electrons are going to, which one? This is a small column density, I'm sorry. Then the electrons are going to heat up everything, the whole cloud at once. Okay, the heating will be uniform. And in that case, it'll disrupt it very quickly. Because they can just sort of seize the heating everywhere when this exterior flow overtakes it. But if you have a higher column depth, then you're only going to heat a skin of this thing, and then that's going to evaporate, and then that evaporation is going to push down on the interior, and you're going to get something much more interesting. All right, so I can show you that here. If you have a low column density cloud, remember I should speak of column density because everything depends on that, not on density and size individually, then the thing just disrupts pretty quickly when it encounters a hot medium. I forget which case this is here. But as you raise it, you see you start to have this cloud that's actually preserved in the center. And that's because the pressure from the evaporating flow has compressed it down. So here's a movie of a case with a density contrast of 1,000 and a velocity of 1,700 and a temperature of 10 to the 7. All right, so the flow is coming in this. I think it'll repeat. Or maybe it won't. I'll repeat it. So the flow comes over this way, and then you see this thing compresses, and then comes out here. So what's going on is there's a pressure gradient around it due to the Mach cone that forms, but there's also the evaporation itself is compressing it. And it compresses down into this sort of narrow filamentary thing that you see like this. And I don't know, when I saw the streamers that you were showing yesterday, that Alberto was showing yesterday, I mean, they look to me like this. Like, I don't know. I mean, the outflow is coming this way. Here's a streamer. Look at this thing here. I know, but I thought it'd be more fun if you didn't know I was about to show this. Wasn't it more fun this way? No? Well, anyway. Yeah, but so anyway, So, I mean, a natural thing that you get is something, this pressure is much higher than the exterior medium because it's evaporation that's compressing it down. And that compression always occurs perpendicular to the way that the hot gas is flowing. So it might be interesting to compare this quantitatively and not just with JPEG, but it sure naturally gives this morphology. We can then compare what, let's see, which ones are these? Yeah, these are the Mach 1 cases here where I'm going to hotter and hotter exterior media. These are without conduction, and these are with conduction, and you can see that they just look completely different. These were extended this way, but these are just like little tubes, like streamers, if you like. At this point, this evolution has absolutely nothing to do with the KH instability. There is no KH instability here at all. There is evaporation that there's evaporative flow going off of this. It's pushing the gas around. It really just doesn't care that this is shearing around. What's important is the rate at which energy is being transferred into the cloud to evaporate the cloud itself. And you can actually, you can go through and provide a fit for what happens in the case with conduction. Here it's just a little bit more complicated, but I'll walk you through it. It's not such a big deal. So you can ask, what is the energy to evaporate material off of the surface? And just balance that with the heat impinging onto the cloud, the rate at which this cloud is having hot flow add new energy to it. And if you balance those things, you do a little algebra, you get something that a time scale that in units of the cloud crushing time depends on this chi naught to the 1/2. All right. So here is, instead of plotting as a function of Mach number now, I'll plot it as a function of this density contrast, because the density contrast is what matters for how long it takes to evaporate. And that works pretty well. So this is the time in cloud crushing times normalized by this factor here. Oh, here it is, normalized by this factor. So, and this is, let's see, this is, yeah, this is T90, T75, T50, T25. And this is the normalized time in terms of that little fit that I showed you. And you can see that there's some outliers, but actually, the reason that they're outliers is because you have to ask yourself, not only, here, there's one more term, and I'll show you here. All right, so, okay. So this time scale comes from balancing the energy impinging on the cloud to evaporation, but the evaporative flow itself radiates energy. Okay, it's a dense region. It's kind of around the peak of the cooling curve. A lot of energy losses can occur in that evaporative flow. So you have to subtract that off of the energy that you're adding to the cloud itself, right? So the evaporative flow is generated, and then it radiates, and that stuff doesn't make it down onto the cloud. If you account for that, you get a little bit more complicated expression, okay? There's this thing G, but here's what G is. You can plug in for any cloud that you like, and then that'll give you time scale, and that works pretty well. So that explains all our results pretty clearly. So essentially, in the case with the conduction, you can throw out KH, you can throw out everything else. It's an energy balance argument, but you better account for the losses in the evaporative flow itself. Okay. Now, in the case with conduction, so here I have the same plot I showed you before. This is the velocity of the clouds as a function of time and cloud crushing times. The black lines are for the case without conduction, and the blue lines are for the case with conduction, okay? So you see some interesting things. So one thing is, some of the clouds live longer, even longer than they did without conduction, okay? And you'd think, well, how could that be? Because they're now evaporating, things are even worse. But the evaporation is sort of insulating it from all this nonsense that's going on around it, right? It's preserving it in a way, and sometimes they can live longer. But it's also compressing them a lot perpendicular to the flow. So the area they're presenting the flow is even smaller than in the case without conduction, right? They're just streamers, so they don't, the flow has almost no effect. So you see something neat. Initially, you get a little bit, sometimes it's even higher than the case without conduction, and this is a rocket effect thing. So you evaporate a little bit off the front, it gets a little kick. But once that kick is over, It gets compressed down and essentially doesn't speed up at all for sort of as long as it lives. It sits there forever almost. Or its velocity evolution is extremely slow. Okay, so conduction only makes it worse to accelerate clouds, although they can live quite a long time, and they live as these streamers. Now, I don't have many results from magnetic fields to show you, but there's definitely what we want to go next with that. And in particular, this is just to keep it in your mind as a caveat for what I'm telling you, because it can lead to two things, right? So you can have dynamically important magnetic fields, which I don't know if that's, they may or may not exist. You have to remember that this hot flow is expanding quite a lot before it encounters this cloud. So magnetic fields are going to probably drop a lot by flux freezing before they overtake the cloud. I'm not sure how easy it will be to preserve a dynamically important magnetic field, but there could be one. But even if there isn't, there'll still be anisotropic conduction. We shouldn't expect isotropic Spitzer conduction in all directions. If there's some magnetic field, even a weak one, that wraps itself around the cloud, then that might change the results to look much more like, say, the case without conduction than with conduction. And so this is what we want to explore next. But right now, it's just a caveat for what I told you before. You just say, oh, I can plug in the numbers, and that's the answer. Right? We know that that's going to be important, and it's not in here. Okay, and in the last, I think I have 3 minutes or something like that, I want to just show you about a little bit about another idea. Okay, so that's originally due to Wang, and then there's these series of papers mostly talking about galaxy outflows driven by starbursts. But Andrea and I have been working on quasar-driven outflows, and the idea here is, can you collapse cold clouds out of a hot flow? All right, so this is a little schematic here. Here you have, this is a quasar-driven case, you have these various phases, but then as you go out to large distances, you could ask, can I just make cold clumps from the hot medium itself, if it's inhomogeneous medium? All right, so we conducted some simulations of that, and the paper's just about done. But in this case, you really have to worry a lot about the presence of a quasar so nearby. I mean, Nick told us even about in the ISM how wrong you are in a regular galaxy, but here you're right next to a quasar. So we use these nice curves that, I don't know, anybody can download this package that he made here. And allows you as a function of what you know, whatever background, you think you can give it a background shape. And you can modify your cooling curves to account for heating, and cooling in the presence of this source that's nearby. And here you have what the cooling and heating look like at the mean density that we assume, which is 60 per cc. And this is at, let's see. The denser you are, the more efficient cooling you are, and the less important the heating is. And at very low density, the heating can be large. And Compton heating can be important too. All right, so we also included dust in these simulations. And the destruction of dust, and you'll see that dust is destroyed pretty quickly, unfortunately. So here's a simulation of, well, let me start it again. All right, so this is a simulation of gas 1 kpc away from a quasar. It starts out at about 2 × 10⁷ degrees, and then we allow it to cool. So this is the fluctuations in density as a function of log time. This is the gas fraction. I mean the dust fraction in solar units. This is the temperature of the gas, and this is the gas pressure. So what you see is, initially, fluctuations are damped. So actually, we put them in quite large. But they're still damped away quite quickly, okay, due to pressure differences and also conduction smoothing things out, too. So they're damped out. But then, as gas starts to cool in the densest regions, suddenly you have large pressure contrasts. Right, so that's, as the movie repeats, you'll see these little red knots form. And that's occurring when this cooling is initially taking place in the densest regions. And then the density contrast zooms up rapidly, so you get these little knots. So things are looking good. We're making cold clouds. But unfortunately, we can't tell the rest of the medium to sort of stop what it's doing and stay hot, right? We'd like to. Well, actually, there's a way to. I'll show you in a second. But since it gets cold too, now the pressure difference reverses itself again. The knots have the highest pressure. Okay, 1 minute and I'll stop. Let me just show you what happens if I raise the background by a factor of 100. Well, then I can rely on Compton heating to keep the low density medium hot. And I can maintain a clone. So here's a clone in this little slice. And there's a few of them in the simulation, not very many. So let's just keep zooming up. But I really have to take an extremely strong background to get that to happen. So at least in this case, it seems like you can't use that mechanism. So I'm out of time, Andre says. So let me just summarize by telling you that in the hydrodynamic case, we have this fifth of the time scale that the clouds live. This is a conductive case. You should keep this in your head, and we can also give a fit for this. And that in the case of cooling, at least around quasars, it looks like it might work, but then if you run things long enough, unfortunately, clumps sort of disperse over time. And I'll wrap it up there.
Oh, streamers.
Yeah. So fantastic, Evan. So one of the striking features in what we see in 253 is the fact that the streamers seem to be coming at the edges of the ionized cone, at the edges of the hot cone. So in other words, they are happening in a place where there is a big, you know, potentially a big density gradient or a big velocity gradient or something like that. I don't know. It seems to be an envelope of a very hot cone that is maybe the fast flow. No? So I'm just curious whether there will be any way in which if you embed here your approximation is just two media, no? There is a fast moving flow and then there is this dense medium. Mm-hmm. So what happens if you embed this in a medium that has some density gradient that is perpendicular to the flow or something like that? Would the presence of another medium actually help you?
So I think what you're saying is, oh gosh, how do I, all the way back to the beginning. Okay, there must be a faster way, but I'm almost there now. So you're kind of here, maybe, you're saying? Like in this region?
I'm at the edges of the cone.
At the edge, right? So you'd expect the flow to be supersonic everywhere, but it would sort of be more supersonic and lower density as you go further out. I don't know. I think the pressure gradient would be even larger, actually. In your case, the pressure gradient would be even larger, so I might stretch it out even more.
I mean, there are many reasons why these things may be at the edges of the hot outflow, but maybe there is something.
Yeah.
Related to survival out there. No?
I think it's harder for it to survive inside, right? So inside, it's a subsonic sort of region. It's harder for it to survive inside of the driving region. And in fact, the Mach number changes quite rapidly right outside the driving region. So there's lots of reason to expect that the environment is very different, even though you haven't moved so far. So that might be a clue, but exactly how to relate it, we should talk about that, I think.
So, Evan, in your study on the cloud evolution, did you always start from the same spherical uniform density cloud, or did you also look at different types of initial conditions? I can imagine some of the clouds may be elementary.
Oh, you mean like a fractal cloud or something?
Yeah,
No, we only did spherical clouds.
Because many of the effects you described may depend on surface pressure.
So people have done some work with fractal clouds. I think, you know, it's sort of, there's a typical scale of your fractal cloud, and within a factor of two, you kind of get the same thing. Mm-hmm. But there hasn't been as many parameter study the way we've done. So I guess that would be interesting to see. But my guess is it's going to be similar to within, say, a factor of two.
So it seems that whatever is the Mach number, the cold clouds is about maybe 10-20% of the hot medium outflow. Do you see that in observations?
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
maybe a bad question. But I guess, so if the cold clouds accelerated by the hot flow, and it seems that in your result, you expect them to have maybe 10-20%.
The velocity ratio?
Yeah,
I see what you're saying.
Can you see that?
Yeah, I'd say that that's actually, it's a good question. I didn't understand it at first, I'm sorry, but yeah.
I had a related question. I mean, the 10-20% for your flow velocity is pretty sizable. It's 300 kilometers per second, so that's pretty significant. So why did you conclude that you cannot accelerate?
I said you can't. Well, you can accelerate. Okay, you're right. I should be more careful what I say. You can accelerate it to something like 10% of the hot flow velocity. So if that's like,
that's a lot.
If that's you could say that's significant or not. So that, I mean, that could be 300. If you take a really, really hot flow, then the hot, in the supersonic regime, you can get the hot medium moving at 3,000. So then that might be substantial, right? And I guess people find kind of around the escape velocity usually with cold clouds, and so those are numbers are more in the hundreds. So
I guess if you can see the hot flow for ionized gas in observations, and then can you compare the ratio?
Well, the hot flow you can see in M82, and you get the temperature of it. You don't. Can't get the kinematics of it. You don't have the X-ray resolution, but you assume this Chevalier and Clegg solution, and you get numbers. I forget which one, but it's around something. If I had to guess, it's 2,000-ish kilometers a second, maybe a bit more that you would expect for the hot medium, the X-ray emitting medium.
Okay, Mark.
Hey, Evan. So it seems like in the magnetized case, I know you're working on it, but it seems like you could make an analytic estimate now. The main effect, I imagine.
Okay.
Well, I imagine, based on what you said, is that the magnetic field will limit how much you can crush the cloud in the transverse direction, right? Because the magnetic pressure will resist, the magnetic pressure goes up faster than the gas pressure when you try and crush the field.
Right.
So I imagine it means it'll mean your cloud has to sort of keep presenting a larger area. You can't crush it as much. So, I don't know, have you thought about trying to, based on that, I would think you would be able to say, for a given initial magnetic field strength, here's how much the cloud can be compressed, therefore its area is reduced by blah, and therefore it should go faster by a certain amount. Have you thought through
no,
that?
No, I haven't done that, but I guess that makes sense. So you would just say, well, I think I arrive at the same pressure, but now it's mostly magnetic pressure.
Exactly.
So therefore the acceleration would be changed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that wouldn't be hard to do. I haven't tried that.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm a little confused as to exactly where you put the clouds into the flow, right? I mean, you're sticking them in out in the outer IMAC region, right? You're just popping them in and letting the stuff wash over them. But, I mean, how did they get there in the first place, right? I mean, wouldn't they be more likely to be embedded down in the lower MAC and possibly even subsonic portions of the flow, right? And got out, right?
It's very hard for them to get out of there. You don't need these simulations to, the previous work would say that it's very hard to do, right? So that's this argument here, right? So if you want to put it in a subsonic flow, then you run into the problem that it will, here it is, it really will disrupt in a handful of cloud crushing times.
Yeah,
that's not very long.
Yeah, so the real question is how do you get it out into the very high mark?
Yeah, I don't know how it's inserted to the flow, so I'm just trying to say, well, I could relate where we see it and how fast it's going to where it might have joined the flow. Sort of agnostic as to exactly when it makes an appearance
there. The results don't matter too much as long as it's in the outer high mach portion of the flow, right? I mean, it all comes out much the same at that point.
Yeah, but I mean, you see stuff like that here, at least in this picture, right? So that's this stuff, right? It's at the edge of this cone that's, right? So this is the outflowing cone, and then at the edge there's material that's being swept up by this. It's clearly high Mach number here, although you don't have a measurement directly of velocity.
So to get back to the velocities, the different velocities of molecular versus hot flows, I mean, there are observations of AGNs where you see the ionized outflows as traced by oxygen-free emission that typically have velocities in excess of 3 of 1,000 kilometers per second, and if you compare for the same AGN luminosity, what is measured in CO, these are typically at lower velocities, less than 500 kilometers per second. in the same, in different objects with different AGN luminosities, but you can see a clear trend where the ionized component is always at much higher velocities and the molecular component is at lower velocity, pretty much in agreement with what you find, just to go back to,
okay,
to the question.
Well, it'd be interesting to try to look at the plot with you and
make comparison. It's Cagnani and collaborators, 2015.
Okay, thank you.
Actually, I have a question also. So the so there is a recent work by Kamarov et al. I think it's a series of papers where they show that even in free flow in plasma, conduction is always suppressed in the presence of magnetic fields by instabilities, by macro, you know, nanoscale mirrors and so on. So magnetic fields always rearranges itself to suppress. So you never get Spitzer, in other words.
Right.
You get maybe at most like 1/4 Spitzer. In the case of clouds moving through hot medium, it's known that the expectation in this case that magnetic field will be quickly wrapped around the cloud. And so it will completely insulate it from so.
Yeah, I think so.
So it's not a question whether, you know, conduction is coefficient is anisotropic or not. It's just suppressed across the interface.
I think it is. So let me see. Let me say something about it, and then you push. So the exact, if I took Spitzer divided by 4, isotropic, nothing would have changed at all. Actually, what had happened is the shock develops would have been hotter because it actually conducts some temperature across the
right,
shock.
Right. So Spitzer divided by 4
wouldn't change, but the wrapping around could be a very important effect, and I totally agree.
So Spitzer by 4 is the maximum you can get. So that's in the free flow
right,
when magnetic field is chaotic, and but here you actually will wrap around, right? So
yes.
And plus, magnetic field provides tension on the surface. That's been studied pretty extensively in the case of cold flows in galaxy clusters. My question is whether, I mean, given all those things, whether anything about conductive case is even relevant. Is there any reason to think that it could be relevant at all?
I don't know how to answer that. I told you that this is an important caveat, and I totally agree that it's because the field lines will wrap around. Now, the dynamical importance of the field, I'm not sure about, but that may also be important. So clearly, this is the next thing to do, but I guess I think it would be premature to say, so then all of this won't have anything to do with clouds as well. I think the answer is we should try to include this and see what happens.
It's been included before in the context of cold flows and galaxy clusters. So all this literature.
Well, those are pretty different. They're subsonic and everything's different.
They're transonic.
Yeah. Okay. So this is a pretty different case, but it may turn out that the conductive results that I showed you completely change when we account for this. That could be true. Yes.
Okay. Right. All right. So let's thank Ivan again. And the next talk is by Emil Stenberg, who will tell us about H1 to H2 transition in star-forming regions.